Hello, listeners. April is Earth Month, and TPL is teaming up with Macy's and its customers to help communities across the country become more resilient to climate change and uplift youth in the process, so the future needs you. Through the month of April, you can round up your in-store purchase or donate online at Macy's.com to turn vacant schoolyards into vibrant parks. And when you donate online or round up in the store, you'll help TPL bring more parks to more people. Since 2022, Macy's extraordinary generosity and partnership has raised over $2.7 million and helped TPL create 12 community schoolyards, benefiting over 6,000 students and 150,000 residents. And fun fact, this partnership is actually helping us transform our first community schoolyard in Cleveland. So thank you to the good folks at Macy's and to their customers for this amazing program. Welcome to People, Nature, Big Ideas. I'm your host, Rhonda Lee Chapman, and today is the first of three special episodes that we'll be running from now through April around a very important piece of legislation called the Outdoors for All Act. The Trust for Public Land has been leading the effort to pass the Outdoors for All Act for a number of years, and just last year, TPL supporters and leaders brought their voices directly to DC to raise attention around it. And since then, the bill has been introduced and has been slowly making its way through the legislative process. So we're keeping our hopes high that the act will pass this April 2024, which would bring about $1 trillion to the outdoor recreation economy. These three episodes are dedicated to what it means to have a true outdoors for all. And so in our first two episodes, we'll talk with community partners who will share what the outdoors means to them, their community, and their culture. We're also going to explore how investing in the outdoors is ultimately an investment in people, in our collective well-being, physically, emotionally, socially, and intellectually. And so in April, for the final episode, we'll follow along for TPL's annual Day on the Hill event in my hometown, Washington, D.C. We're going to talk with lawmakers, advocates, TPL staff, and journalists about how these kinds of bills get created, how they're passed, and what kind of impact they can have on communities across the United States. So that was a lot to set up, but hopefully it helps provide a map so you can see where we're headed. So let's get into it. I'm really excited to kick off the series with Erica Hood, one of the co-founders of SIAT, which is a family-founded organization based in East Cleveland. Their mission is to support its community through culturally relevant programming in the natural and built environment. And we'll also be joined by Sean Terry, Associate Vice President, Ohio State Director, who will share the importance of being in relationship with community groups like SIAT and their exciting collaboration to transform a local park, and why the outdoors is so vital in creating more accessible, health-supporting, and resident-friendly spaces. So I'd like to thank you both for joining me today, and welcome to People, Nature, Big Ideas. Hello, Sean and Erica. How are you?
Doing good, thanks.
Hey. Doing good.
Hey. So, you know, Erica, I want to start with you, and I first want to have you give a quick summary of what you all do at SIAT.
So in 2009, you know, we were founded, but it was just kind of happenstance. Like, we just wanted to answer the call to a need, and that need would be to diversify outdoor recreation and get young people to, you know, experience more outdoor activities in a way that is familiar to them, comfortable to them, with people who look like them. So that's what we do. We curate experiences for our community to just feel Black joy in the outdoors. And we were founded on the east side of Cleveland, not East Cleveland, but the east side of Cleveland.
Okay.
Where program now has grown nationally and internationally.
That's amazing. You know, every story needs to be rooted in its history. And I want to know if you can share with myself and the audience what the acronym that SIAT stands for.
So SIAT was a calling like to my mom. Essentially, she is the one who wanted to start the organization. Like, hey guys, why don't we do something to diversify? You know, it all started in winter skiing. So she wanted to see if we can get some kids from the community to experience downhill skiing. And we were like, sure, mom, we got you. My sister and I had the experience skiing before, so we were all for it. Her goal to see you at the top was, you know, a lot of times when you go skiing at a ski resort and you ride the chairlift up, that's your meeting place at the top of the hill. So it's like, we'll hop in line, we'll get on the chairlift, and I'll see you guys at the top before we, you know, get our plan for coming down. So that's kind of how it started. But we also wanted to use that as a reference to see you at the top of your classrooms, at the top of your community. Like, there are so many different ways that you can elevate young people in different spaces where we can encourage them to be elevated and just strive for more for themselves as well and support them in that. So that's where see you at the top came from. We use it now in a lot of different ways and kind of chuckle about it.
I love it. So for the listening audience, SYAT, as I'm saying, is SYATT.
Yes.
See you at the top. I absolutely love that. I mean, it's a metaphor for everything. As you said, it's about being on the mountain. It's about being in community. It's about kind of how you uplift yourself on the daily when you wake up in the morning and you're thinking about what you have in front of you. And you have to look at yourself and say, I have got this. I'm going to get to the top of this mountain, whatever that mountain might look like, be it a policy, be it whatever the case. So I really, really love that.
Absolutely.
I know when we were talking before, you had mentioned a little bit about your mother, and I want to recognize her in particular. I think the way I was raised, you always want to honor your elders. And I'm curious to hear about, you know, as you were talking about her vision, your family, you're out skiing on the mountain. She just wanted you all to get out there and play and have a relationship with the outdoors. And so she's got this profound love for learning and being out there. But do you have any idea where that even came from for her? Is this something that is unique to her and her family line? Or is this something that she kind of gained from her own parents or the folks who surrounded her as a child?
Yeah, you know, my grandfather is now 98 years old. So like, we get a lot of stories from him still to this day about how he chose to raise his children and make sure that they were exposed to a lot of different things, taking them to world fairs and just, you know, really allowing them time to experience outdoors. And my grandmother was the same way. You know, she packed her kids up and she traveled. You know, my mom grew up in the South, so she made that trip up north with my grandmother, and they still brought some of those traditions and practices that, you know, kept them outside a lot and being one with nature. So when she met my dad, they were young, they were kindred spirits, and they, you know, bought a car, they would pack up, you know, the family and head out west and say, let's just experience this. I remember, you know, growing up and going to the AAA with my dad, getting triptychs. So we would travel, you know, whenever we made that inaugural trip down south to go see family, you know, we would get a triptych and we would see what can we stop and see along the way. And those stops were national parks. Those stops were different spaces that brought you to outdoors. They were national seashores that we would make it to, like places that I didn't even know existed, were the stops along the way that were our rest stops in a way. So it was just something that was second nature for me and my sister to then, you know, be in the outdoor space now. And now that I have my two children, it has definitely trickled down to them. So, you know, my mom was just, I would say she's the oldest of her siblings and she's a trailblazer in a way. You know, she's just an amazing person. She'll be 70 this year. And some of the things that I've seen her push herself to do to support our young people, learning how to ski and just, you know, she's an avid bike rider. She has run marathons. Like, she's just amazing. She's a great example. And she really sets the tone for that intercultural connection. That SYAT, you know, really, it's the family part of SYAT. And she's like everyone's grandma in a way.
I love that so much. And it's like, so you are part of the Great Migration family line, right? And SYAT in and of itself is this intergenerational experience, which I think is so powerful because so many things kind of fall by the wayside and we lose tradition. And so this tradition and being connected to the outdoors is actually, I don't think it's regularly recognized when we talk about the outdoors in this national context here in the United States. When we look in magazines and we hear stories, we very rarely hear the story of the Hood family. We don't hear about SYAT, and we really need to hear more about your family story. So I'm really, really grateful that you're here to share this with us and to also share it with TPL. So thank you. I want to turn it over to you, Sean, and curious about a straight line maybe you can draw between the outdoors and what it is that drew you to the Trust for Public Land. You've been giving us your great thinking, your fantastic leadership, your generosity for the last few years. What's the connection?
Thanks, Rhonda. Honestly, lots of synergy with what Erica mentioned. Like, my love for the outdoors and my passion for parks and conservation in general was really seated in my upbringing. I was born and raised in Chicago during an era when city parks were gang and crime laden. So my early years, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time doing park district summer camps because that wasn't really the safest option for where I live. So I actually spent summers during my formative years with my grand aunt and cousins who lived in a more rural part of Illinois. Erica, you may recall my stories about Aunt Bessie. She was our family green thumb. She had quite the extensive spread, fruit-bearing trees and melons and vegetables and all the things that we learned to tend as kids. I think that was her way of keeping us busy, but also her way of bridging that generational gap that you talk about, of our family origins and the agrarian lifestyle that she knew and learned in the South and in Alabama. And those experiences and memories for me were some of my fondest growing up. As I grew into my teen years, my high school experience really became that path for me gaining confidence and independence through parks and further exposed me to conservation. I attended an agricultural high school. We had an integrated curriculum that emphasized all aspects of agriculture, everything from plant science to animal science, harvest days on the school farm, and agribusiness. Students managed the farm stand, but also played baseball in one of the more competitive programs and conferences in the city. So we traveled all over the city, not just like rival schools on the south side. We were all over the city. And baseball is pretty unique. It's an vantage point that lets you see parks in a different light, largely because there's no clock. You can be in the park all day. And we were in different neighborhoods with a mixture of cultural makeups. And so I experienced what it was like to be in a park in an underserved neighborhood with poorly maintained spaces and rough areas and backdrops versus being in other parks that were very safe and pristine and insulated and had like really strong resident ownership. And so, you know, one of the things that we often talk about is the importance of programming and occupancy. And you know, again, like baseball really is sort of like a first line of defense in terms of park safety. Because of that programming aspect and that time in park, it can have a huge impact on really protecting the park space. And then lastly, for me, just when I went away to college, I closed the gap in my own origin story and went back to Alabama, if you will, studied environmental science and community planning as a USDA 1890 land grant scholar, did internships and practical assignments and with the USDA Forest Service. And that really balanced my inner city experience with more rural and small town conservation spaces. The learning arc was really significant and tough at times. It really allowed me to develop that resilience that we as people of color need in this space, quite frankly. I was in communities where I was among the stark minority, saw racism and experienced microaggressions up close. And ultimately, I feel like that braced me for the types of challenges we encounter still to this day in terms of, you know, fighting to bring equity in these spaces.
Wow. You know, you said a lot of really rich kind of gems in your history, your personal lived history, and you touched on something that I had never thought about, and that is the relationship with baseball and the travel that comes with that and the different parks that you get exposed to and just kind of the multicultural component of that. I played soccer and ran track. And so I was always traveling also for either soccer games or track meets. And I never made that connection. I think it was maybe in my subconscious, Sean. So thank you for sharing that framing for me. Because I don't think I realized it when I was in the moment. Oftentimes, when I think about outdoors, and one of the things we've talked about on this show a couple of times is particularly as Black folks and Black communities and other communities that are made of people of color, and their experiences in the outdoors, it has a really tremendous range. So whether we're talking about, these vast wilderness spaces, or in your case, a baseball field, and in some instances, when we're talking about the city context in particular, it can be just be a sidewalk. It can be the balcony. Any place that the sun is shining is the outdoors. And I think about, when I lived in Utah, people, I have to explain myself often when people are like, I'm sorry, you lived in Utah for how long? And what were you doing? And it was just me. This is in the 90s, right? Me on the mountains, just kind of ripping it up, having the time of my life. I consider it like part of my formative years, but I was the only Black person on the mountain. And it was myself and I think five or six other Latino brothers that I had from California who were there. And we were anomalies, and people were always so curious about us. And sometimes it was like, just let us be. We're just here playing in the snow like the rest of y'all. Like, there's nothing special. I don't have any superpowers. Let's just ride. So it makes me think about another part that we want to talk about in our conversation, and that is representation. And so, Erica, you shared some of Syed's origin story, and you talked about, representation being kind of the impetus for it all, for the Syed's development. And you talked about in a conversation we had about, growing up and looking at, Black Olympic athletes and other people of color who were Olympic athletes. And so when we talk about today's social climate, there's so much happening in our world right now. And I'm curious how you think about the ways cultural representation can impact sports and outdoor activities.
I think within our community is 1,000% one of the most important aspects of the work that we do is representation. So a lot of times, when you hear the phrases, that's white people stuff, that's not stuff that we do, we are just further distancing ourselves from that actual activity. So I just feel if we can allow our kids to see us in these roles, then they'll be able to see themselves in a role and not just think that it's a one-off activity or just, this was something that I was allowed to experience before I left that space to them. You know what I'm saying? So representation is super important. So we make sure that in everything that we do for Saya, I may not be an expert at it, but I do it, I try it, and where I can be an expert or be certified at it, I am. So my mom, like I said, she was older when Saya started. She was well into the 50s, but she was like, you know what? I have to give this a try because I want to be able to speak to this experience when a kid is coming to me with some challenges that they're having as far as skiing goes. I want to be able to speak to that anxiety or that nervousness that they're having and, kind of help them walk through it. And who would I be if I don't have that experience? So, authenticity is huge for us. I was skilled, cold when it came to skiing. Snowboarding was brand new for me. I knew I wanted to do it, but once our kids challenged us with snowboarding, then that was something that I had to do. So here I am in my 30s, two kids, still feeling young and youthful, but my body was like, what are we doing here? I took those falls a lot harder than I did when I learned how to ski. But I will say now that they keep me on our toes, keep me and my sister on our toes when it comes to our skills with everything that we do, certified, scuba diver. Every single thing that we can get certified in. And if it's something that takes more skill, then we find experts that look like us. We are out here, we exist. We don't have to always default to these larger organizations that offer opportunities for inner city kids to try this, that, and the third. There are so many Black and Brown outdoor recreation programmers across the country that are willing to partner. And that's kind of how Syed formed one of our, like offspring organizations with some of our partners. It's called Get Black Outside. And that's just a way to connect with more Syeds across the country. And we form a partnership. So a lot of our scuba diving work takes place in partnership with the Tennessee Aquatic Project in Nashville. And we're just connecting with all these different folks so that our kids can see it's not just us here. Like, it's a ton of folks out here. So wherever you go, you can tap into this network and see yourself.
My goodness, I love that so much. And I'm not 70. I'm in between you and your mom, right? When it comes to my age. And I think about when I see these evolutions and advances or advocacy or just activities that folks are cultivating today, I think about, wow, if I were a kid today, how lucky I would feel, you know, to be able to have a SIAT in my neighborhood, because they really did not exist when I was a kid. I grew up with the more traditional, like, Girl Scouts and Brownies and those kind of institutions. They also introduced me to the outdoors, right? But there's also these more intimate kind of family oriented, hyper local advancements or connections that can be made that I'm hearing is coming out of Cleveland. And when you think about the past 15 years and the work that SIAT has been doing, how have you seen it play out with some of the very first, I don't know, what do you call them, SIATers? Those first kids?
We need a name Beehive. We need something fancy.
we need to give them a name. But those very first ones that came through the door when you all were younger, 15 years ago, you were young 15 years ago. How have you seen that impact play out from the very first folks, the very first young ones that came through SIAT? Where are they now 15 years later?
You know, these are kids that we are completely obsessed with. Like, we love them so much. They are our babies. And I will say, as much as we could let them go, they chose to still stay connected with us. And now we can see, as they are in their, you know, mid-20s, just how much the organization meant to them when they come back to us and share amazing news with them about their careers. We have some that have matriculated into the military. We have some who are college graduates now, some who are working and coming back to SIAT and, you know, are working as like a program assistants for us now. So not only are they coming back, they want to come back to volunteer, but we're like, oh, we're going to make sure you get paid for this. Like, that's very important for us. Because again, I am 15 years older than I was when I first started. So we still need young, relevant, you know, folks to stay connected to this work as we begin to get older. So we have folks who are in STEM careers. We have some entrepreneurs who, and I would say too, as these individuals have grown out of SIAT programming and life has begun to take over, you know, a lot of their priority, they're beginning to shape and mold, you know, what their future looked like. So it may have taken them away from SIAT. We have begun to find a place for them. So now we call them like our OGs. So there'll be like a SIAT OG text message thread. They stay connected. They go see each other at college. So they'll take road trips to the University of Cincinnati to go celebrate one of the OG's birthdays. And then we'll get a mom to say, send us a picture and say, hey, the OGs are at my house for a campfire. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, so is my family there? Like, it's just crazy. So they are a family. They are very well connected and they are a family. So we are able to also help them. The ones that may still be struggling, trying to figure it out, help them with some of the resources that we formed throughout the 15 years of this work, and some of our friends, you know, just to try to keep them on track, as we have some who want to do piloting. We have some in the nursing field, some in physical therapy. So they're doing really, really well. When we look at our stats for that OG cohort, 99% of them are either in, have finished college or gone to the military, had a STEM career, or have their own business. Like, they're all doing amazingly well. So we want to bring them back to be the examples for our new SIAT cohorts that are now 10th, 11th, 12th grade in high school and figuring it all out. But they are an amazing example for our kids for the future.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And, you know, it just really underscores, you know, one of the things that we hold up at TPL is the outdoors being the connector, right? Being the bridge for so many things. And so, Sean, I want to turn over to you and on this theme of representation, thinking about what you see in Cleveland. And when it comes to Black and Brown folks and conservation, what comes to mind for you in your community? You shared some about your own origin story, but maybe talking at the highest level and talking about the type of activation you're seeing in Cleveland, what's happening there with Black and Brown folks and conservation?
Yeah, so I stepped into my role as a Black leader in conservation here, determined not to just lift up our mission of connecting everyone to the outdoors, but also determined to like truly center community and leverage our outputs in a way that builds on access and gets to the core of some of the underlying challenges around health and the need for wellness and mindfulness and building the type of resilience that is necessary to make future generations of Black and Brown folks better prepared to deal with quality of life issues that come up with climate change, for instance. So you might not be drawn to the outdoors, but cost of food continues to rise and the quality of what we consume continues to get more and more suspect. So we better be about knowing how to tap into nature in order to survive. And that's what our ancestors, you know, taught us. And a lot of that is already inherent in our DNA. But as it relates to TPL's relationships you know, partnerships are vital to keeping community at the core. It's important for us to learn the culture and not be overly prescriptive when we step into a community. That helps us better understand how a TPL can lead from behind, but it also helps us to stay true to the community voice and the perspective of local leadership. I'm not from Cleveland, as I mentioned earlier, so I've had to be very intentional about that. Learning the culture, centering community in order to build trust and understand the dynamics of neighborhoods that have been at play well before TPL stepped into the space. I've been in Ohio now for 4 years. And one of the first things that I learned was that the four city moniker is something that Cleveland residents take seriously and with pride. In my experience, cities that have been, that have like an embedded culture of conservation in nature, oftentimes don't necessarily have Black community at the table or Black community present, but that wasn't and is not the case in Cleveland. As a matter of fact, there's like an entire Black community of leaders and stakeholders who have been at this work for a long time, ensuring that Black and Brown representation is at the table, SIA included. So not only to just influence the park investment that we often talk about, but also to remind officials and key decision makers that there are bigger pressing histories of environmental injustices that need to be course corrected. So I've gained a lot of respect for the movement here and the work that groups like SIAD have been doing for some time now. There's been a lot of work to build this relationship between TPL and SIAD, but it's been personally refreshing for me to experience. And this goes back to like 2022, I'm coming off of sort of the high point of COVID and me kind of re-engaging in you know, conferences and things of that nature in person. And in January 22, I sat in a powerful session that SIAD delivered on inclusion at the annual Ohio Parks and Recreation Conference. We built time and spent time together at City Parks Alliance and Greater Greener in Philadelphia. And we have even like bumped into each other during family time in the parks. And it, being authentic, as Erica mentioned, and relatable is something that really, you know, resonated with me about SIAD. Beyond the mission alignment, right? I love how intentional they are about not being dictated to and not needing to be invited to the table and then given a script, but, you know, really, we got this. And that confidence, they exude that. And so I'm really excited to explore our growing relationship. There's so many projects that I can dabble on and talk more about, but, you know, we're really at the starting point and are starting to sow seeds now for what I hope will really be transformative work together.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to scale out a little bit. So we've been talking very intentionally about Cleveland and what we're seeing in community. And we're talking about outdoor spaces. And my mind is starting to shift a little bit towards national representation in outdoor spaces. And Erica, when we were having a conversation before, you told a story about traveling to DC. I don't know how many people are aware that the National Park Service has some of the largest acreage of land that they own and manage here in Washington, DC. And, you know, folks who've been fortunate enough to come here and go to the Smithsonian Institute and the National Mall and all of those really iconic places. You were talking about being here in DC, and I'm always lifting up DC. I can't help it. and the different kinds of representation you saw among National Park staff. I don't want to tell the story for you. Can you share that story about that experience?
You know, I think as avid National Park visitors, so we have our National Park passport books. We take it seriously. Like, we are super serious about getting our passport book stamped. We are, you know, seeking out these spaces. And when you go to DC, if only our national parks nationally could look like how it looks in DC with diversity. You go to certain regions and you just see a nice mix and representation of all people in these spaces. So when you go into some of these more historic spots, like let's just say like Frederick Douglass, you know, home or something like that. Like, you go to these places to learn about your history, but you're seeing people who look like you who are talking about this history. And for us, I think it's made a huge impact because it lets your guard down. You feel comfortable. You're asking questions that just naturally, you know, roll off your tongue, and you're finding out so much more information. As you travel the country, that is just less likely to happen at certain regions when you are going to into some of these larger, more iconic parks, and the representation is just not there. Most recently, we were at Yosemite National Park, iconic space. You can't step into the ground of the Yosemite National Park and not have your jaw literally just drop to the floor because it's just so beautiful of a space. And when you say these are public lands, like, this is all mine to enjoy, it's amazing. But where are my people at? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm looking around, like, where are my folks at? This is instantly, physically, I feel amazing just being within that space. But to look around and to not see your community there is heartbreaking. And then to not see your community there even working is heartbreaking. So we did run into a young lady, I think, on the conservancy side of Yosemite. And we were so happy to see her. Then also a few, two young ladies of color who worked on the National Forest side that were close to, like, Vining, California. They weren't in Yosemite National Park, but we saw them at a park forest stop. And we walked in the door and we just all broke into the largest smiles, took selfies, exchanged social media. Let me know if you need anything. Next time you come to California, we can help arrange a trip. Bring more of us here is what they wanted us to do. And essentially, you know, I asked them, like, well, how do you all kind of get back to feeling like yourself? And how do you get back to, like, you know, getting those little pieces of your culture in this, you know, kind of super rural, super white space where there's not a Black person in sight. And they're both their answers where we go home. Like, we literally have to go home. So when they come to work, they aren't their full self. They can't be their full self. So the more and more that they see people that look like them walk in the door, they get fed, you know, and we got fed. So it is so important for our national parks and our national forests to continue to put effort in dollars and re-strategizing, working with partners like us to try to help think through pipelines and mechanisms to make sure more of us are, you know, represented at these national parks and these national forests, and then to make sure that organizations and the environment and the culture is ready for diversity as well.
So for now, I'd like to transition a little bit into another area. And at the start of the conversation today, I announced that we were kicking off this three-part series for the Outdoors for All Act, which is hopefully slated to pass this spring. But we know that Congress moves in mysterious ways. And so I'd like to ask you both to reflect on what kind of impact legislation of this type can have in the communities where you work. And Sean, maybe you can speak on thinking about a little, or offering, I guess, a little more detail about what the bill is intended to accomplish. Thinking about how you can maybe break the bill down for the listening audience, if you can, and then following up with, again, the type of impact that that legislation is going to have.
Yeah, and I know this is a big part of, you know, as our lead up to TPL's Advocacy Day on the Hill this year. I'm really excited to be amongst the thought leadership for the first time in person. Nationally, we'll be introducing language designed to catalyze funding for targeting investment in school districts that will complement our community schoolyards initiative. We launched our Ohio Community Schoolyards program in 2023 and have big plans for growing the program. So laying the groundwork will hopefully have a direct impact on our program. But that aside, I'm most excited to continue building on the momentum TPL has gained around the Outdoors for All Act. At a high level, the bill is really designed to dedicate resources for projects that can build infrastructure to increase connections to the outdoors and increase recreational opportunities, particularly in urban and low-income communities. Interestingly enough, Ohio Congressman Mike Turner was one of the original bill sponsors and even references 10-minute walk, the TPL 10-minute walk initiative, and calls out the walk shed in the city of Dayton and the intentions on, you know, leveraging funding to improve that walk shed. I think right now, 78% of Daytonians live within a 10-minute walk. But one of the key programs that the bill will continue to fund is the Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership Program, or ORLP, via the Land and Water Conservation Fund. ORLP is a program that the city of Cleveland has already proven successful in securing, and TPL played a moderate role in sort of approaching that, that program and requesting funding for Clark Fulton, which is one of our high need communities. and we're excited to explore that program for funding in other high need communities. There are a couple projects that are on the TPL side horizon that come to mind. One in particular is Carouche Park, which is located on the southeast side. Funding through RRP can potentially position us to take existing seed funding that we already have in place, thanks to the International Mountain Bike Association and some others, to jumpstart community dialogue around enhancing an existing park with multi-use and mountain bike trails. Now, and this is, you know, part of the learning and getting to know SIAT, I discovered last year that this isn't a first time that the community will be having this dialogue. Carouche Park was a location that the city of Cleveland explored in 2015 for a mountain bike park. And within the process of community dialogue, there were some real pressing concerns that came up around public safety, public nuisance, ATV riding and motocross bikes. That's a bit of a subset of Cleveland's culture was very much present in Carouche Park. And Erica could probably speak to that better than I can. But the relationship with EMBA is going to allow us to revisit that conversation in a way that one may not have been as comprehensive now that we have a city parks department that's on the horizon, a first time ever park master plan. The city's making all of these steps to prioritize funding and investment in parks. Let's revisit this conversation and let's unpack further the concerns around public nuisance and safety and pivot it in a way that's going to hopefully address the macro issues, but then also create a pathway for introducing a demographic that is not currently prevalent in mountain biking to a new sport. Like we'll always find thrill seeking opportunities in urban settings. That's just what we do. And so if there's already a subset of a culture in place, can we tap into that, re-envision what that looks like, and hopefully get our younger demographic especially introduced to a sport that they can find equally fun and that offers, the same type of thrill seeking, but in a way that meshes more naturally with the public and not create a friction point. And RRP could really, I mean, we have seed funding to explore the dialogue and do community engagement, but the RRP program in particular can really be one that brings some reality to the project and hopefully seeds funding for construction. Originally, when that community dialogue happened, the cost opinion for construction was around $850,000. That's a lot of money that was unplanned. The city didn't necessarily have earmarked. And so this could very easily be a program that we tap into to bring some reality to that project.
I love it. I love hearing stories and witnessing situations where federal national policies are actually making it to the hyperlocal level. Erica, I'd love to hear, I know that you two are excited about this project and the collaboration together. And I personally am excited. I'm feeling like I'm long overdue for a trip to Cleveland, to be honest with you. And then thinking very specifically about Carouche Park, I want to ask you two questions. One is, I want to hear your reaction to this sentiment around nuisance. I, for some reason, that triggers me in a really interesting way in my brain, not knowing the context, not being there. It feels like a racialized term potentially. And so I'm not entirely sure. And I would love to hear your feedback on that or even an explanation of what they mean. It could just be the sound of ATVs. I'm not really sure. And then the second thing I'd love to hear from you is about SIAT's world in the world of biking. I think that you all have some experiences there on activating programming that includes bicycles. So can you share your responses?
Yeah, we've definitely, Carouche Park is just, it's an amazing park. So that's a neighborhood that I grew up in. That's a neighborhood where, you know, my both maternal and paternal grandparents settled and my parents met each other in that community. So the park was my second home. It's where we stayed until that streetlight came on and we had to make our way home, you know? So it has gone through many different phases. A lot of the investment has gone into the park to date and you see it reflected in the visitors that are at the park now. The park is super diverse. Let me not say super diverse, but for the southeast side of Cleveland, I'm going to say it's super diverse. There are folks there who are coming from different communities to use tennis courts and to play cricket and to do soccer. Like it is, we have a population of older adults who do golfing and practice their swings in the park. Like, folks are activated all across the park. I think when it comes to this idea around the mountain bike park, there are other communities that are doing this in rural communities. It's just something new and that we have not seen in it. While a lot of our 10 years ago, a lot of our work around investment in the park was being led by community members who were outside that target demographic, you know, and it is loud. And I think what they had to reference were some of the more rogue ATV street riders. So, you know, Cleveland, like many other cities across the nation, you know, will have a group of, you know, young folks who hop on their ATVs or their mountain bikes, and they're like 100 deep and they're, you know, zooming down the street. So yes, is it the most safest thing to do? Absolutely not. Are they having fun? I'm sure. But when that's your reference, it's like, we don't want that. We don't want that in our parks at all whatsoever. But when it can be done in a constructive way with structure around it, with safety around it, and I think creating from a younger audience a culture for really diversifying what we do, baseball, basketball, you know, that's not the only things that we can do at this park. We can't step outside of that. The area where the proposed mountain bike park will go is absolutely gorgeous. It is beautiful. It's like a little hidden gem. You can see it from off of the freeway, but when you get back there and actually get to walk around it, it's like, if you didn't have the sounds of the freeway, I think you would feel like you were in rural Ohio. It's beautiful. So I think it's something that our community definitely deserves. I think we're now 10 years after that initial proposed idea. And SIAT has done a lot of work. There are so many other community organizations that are now activated in Carouge Park with younger audiences and younger programmers that I think will be on board for this 100%. We've done bike rodeos in the park, so we're prepared to do, you know, a lot more programming around safety and making sure young people know how to properly prepare themselves. Now, mountain biking is different from putting ATVs out there. You know, it's completely different. But as far as like a mountain biking park, 1,000%, I think kids will enjoy it. I think community members will enjoy it. And I think it'll bring diversity to the park. I know some other folks will kind of come over and experience the space. It'll be a destination area in the southeast side of Cleveland for sure. And I think we can capitalize off of that as well and get people excited.
I love it. Sean, the city of Cleveland, you mentioned this moments ago, is developing its first master plan for parks and rec. Master plan. Wow, it's a really powerful term. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what a master plan might offer for community groups like SIAT and the other community groups that you're talking about. We've talked about Carouge Park, but are there other areas where the city's master plan for parks and recreation can really have a direct impact that you're exploring?
Absolutely. And maybe comprehensive plan is a more appropriate term. This is a first ever endeavor for the city of Cleveland. The plan itself has a 15-year trajectory. So this is all about making priorities around parks and green space as a priority land use for the city. The existing city assets, first and foremost, but are there opportunities to create stronger connections to those spaces, to create community-based and community-led programming that may take place in vacant lots, something that we have a ton of, to either increase access or increase park acreage or create new pocket parks that are interwoven and that will connect community parks to one another to create safer, you know, routes to the park. I think that the city has taken a very open and receptive approach to following the vision of community. There's a consultant that was brought in, Olin, who's sort of spearheading this effort, but Trust for Public Land was brought in as a technical advisor, a nonprofit advisor, and we've been really pushing on, you know, creating a space where we move at the pace of community. The priorities that ultimately are going to be embedded in the plan itself lean into the value system, if you will, of creating relevant spaces that are culturally inspired and reflective of the diversity of Cleveland. So credit to the city for really being ambitious and in its first ever plan. Oftentimes parks are sort of the last funded first cut in terms of the city budgeting, and not just here in Cleveland, but I think that that's sort of, you know, national precedence around that. You can ask folks and our peers in other cities, they may have the same challenge, but I think that the city of Cleveland has been very intent on exploring what the cross departmental conversations are like between the capital projects division, which is where the ultimately the parks department will live, and other departments that have, you know, key inflection points around park investment and park maintenance. So everything from public works to sustainability to the Department of Planning, like how can we have these departments better integrated and better communication with one another so that these really audacious and bold plans actually come to life and it's not just a plan that sits on a shelf.
I love that. Thank you. Erica, I do want to talk to you for just a moment. As when I was hearing Sean kind of from a practical standpoint refer to the city's plan as a comprehensive plan, I think it made me think instantly about some of the commitments we have at TPL, one of which is equity, another is, you know, climate resilience, and we talk about community strategy, but we also talk about community health. And I believe that you've got a background in public health. And I'd love to hear you kind of draw out the connection between public health and the outdoors. Some of your thoughts on that.
It has been proven that nature has healing benefits. And we've known this from recent research all the way back to, you know, traditional, more indigenous knowledge that we've uncovered and how people use the outdoors to heal. Our job at SIAT is just to get folks there. And we always say that nature's going to do the rest. Once they get outside and they begin to experience, you know, the healing benefits of nature, then, you know, our job is done. You know, hopefully, you know, they'll be sold and we're done with it. I think that COVID has shown a lot of folks in the inner city just how important it is to be outside, you know, when you are compromised, when it comes to, you know, challenged with seeing your family, when you feel cooped up, when you're fearful and you have anxiety because, you know, there's so many different things going on in the world and changes. When money is an issue, what can you do? Get outside, take a walk, sit on your porch. You know, that COVID outdoor experience did not look the same for everyone, depending on where you live. And that was, I think, the most heartbreaking. So, if, you know, folks didn't have a city park to go to where they felt safe, that is where we need to do a better job. So that is where our park plan can do a better job. That's where legislation can help and ensure that, you know, not asking for another crisis, but just seeing how COVID left such an impact, letting people know that they can use their city parks as a place of respite. Our job is also to have our community members think beyond that, taking the fear and the history and that unfortunate legacy that's tied to the African-American community when it comes to our association with water, the African-American community with our association to outdoors and the forest. And, you know, you think all of that legacy is in our DNA when it comes to, you know, the Atlantic slave trade, when it comes to the Underground Railroad, you know, the outdoors was used as, it was second nature to us, but then it became a tool for survival. And then it also became an unfortunate resting place for many people who didn't survive. So, you know, our outlook on the outdoors, you know, it wasn't a safe space. And beginning to change that narrative is going to take time. And it's going to take all of us across the country. I watch Instagram and TikTok, and I see so many different organizations and individuals who are sharing their experiences in the outdoors and inviting others to come outside. And I'm like, yes, yes, let's continue to do the work. It's going to take all of us to begin to change that narrative for our people and begin to use the outdoors again in ways that we did, you know, 400 years ago as a safe space, as a place that we were able to, you know, connect as a people and fellowship and, you know, use to our benefit and also give back to. So I think that's one of the most challenging things, especially when people look around in their city and see their city parks aren't equipped with, you know, safe equipment for their kids to even play. There's a lot of gun violence and things going on. So, you know, the challenges are still there. But when we begin to, you know, take our community outside of those spaces or find ways for them to connect or create their own little oasis for, you know, to get outside and experience outdoors, you know, I think one thing that we do at SIAT is from the smallest connection all the way to, you know, sitting on a beach and looking at the ocean. You know, we have to make sure that we cover all those different touch points to make sure community members have access to something. So I would never say that your backyard or your porch is not good enough for you to get outside and get some sunshine and vitamin D. I would never say that. So we're saying from your porch to the beach, you know, your porch to the top of a mountain, we need to do it all because every single time that we experience outdoors, it will heal us.
Ooh. That was nothing but a word. Thank you so much. I have so many thoughts that I want to respond with. It's probably best for me to just say, I feel very seen. Thank you for sharing that, Erica. And it's almost like you live inside my head. So Sean, I want to think about the opportunities that we're talking about, right? We're talking about parks, large and small. We're talking about comprehensive plans. We're talking about, you know, significant government funding opportunities. Localized community groups like SIAT have a lot of wisdom embedded in their organizations. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. And that's, again, community being core to what we do. We need to be partnering with a SIAT and organizations like SIAT and every TPL city in order to usher the work forward and authentically, for sure.
I love it. I want to pass it over to you, Erica, to reflect on all of the things that groups like SIAT have to bring to the table. What do you all know that might otherwise be overlooked were you not engaged? And let me put that another way. I am regularly thinking about the tension between erasure and representation. So we talked about representation a little while back. And if SIAT's not in the room, TPL misses out on something. Right. What is that something that SIAT offers that TPL doesn't have on its own intrinsic value?
You know, I think another portion of our work is elevating SIAT. I know we're using that kind of term, like other SIAT, other programmers, elevating the work that we do and seeing ourselves as experts. So what you miss out on is another thought partner. You miss out a lot of times. What we see is that you miss out on the actual folks with the lived experience, the actual folks who will be using these spaces. So many times our parks and programming is designed by folks who won't even be the ones who sign up for it, nor their kids, won't even be impacted by whether or not it existed. You know, so when you pull in groups like SIAT, folks who are from the community, serving the community, who are look like the community and have those same cultural challenges and barriers, then we're able to, I think, prepare ourselves to better plan programming, plan infrastructure where there are the less amount of barriers. So it's like, let's not think about, you know, let's think about X, Y, and Z ahead of time. We already know that this is a challenge for our community, and let's get ahead of that. So it's being able to be a voice, an unapologetic voice, sometimes a squeaky wheel, an agitator, however you want to say it, but being able to be that because we are our own entity. You know, I love Sean and I love the work that he does. And, you know, again, this relationship that we built is just, we're kindred spirits, definitely kindred spirits. Mm-hmm. And I love when you can get, have a partnership where it just feels good. And a lot of times we have folks that are in the roles who work for some of these government entities or, you know, park systems, and they may look like us, but they need our help. They need a SIAT in the room to sometimes say the things that they may not be comfortable saying in their job. So they may feel it with all of their heart, but at the end of the day, that's their check. So it's like, how can SIAT be there to support our people who are in these roles to say, you know, what needs to be said, and, you know, and support them and uplift them in their roles as well. So I'll say that SIAT has a lot of more positive reflections. Like, we can now sit in our little office and say, look at all the ways that we've had, you know, we've made an impact. And I'll say, you know, 10 years ago, we talked about, you know, how do we get at the table? I think now it's, what other table can we take over? You know, like, what other table can we create and invite folks to? So I think, you know, in the last 10 years, we've done a lot of work to make sure that our voices were heard on behalf of our community, and making sure that our community members were in spaces where they too can speak up on their own behalf. We are definitely not the voice for all folks in Cleveland, if, you know, folks of color in Cleveland at all, but I know we do a fabulous job of uplifting those that we do serve and making sure that they feel the power to speak out as well, you know, on their own behalf. So mm-hmm. I would say, who are you connected to? Who are your partners? First question we ask any organization that we're working with, who are your current partners? And that's where we start, because we see how powerful it is and how intentional you are if you've connected with, you know, groups of color who are doing this work and who have been doing this work.
Thank you for that. You know, I know that you all have your mission statement on your website, but one of the things that was coming up for me as you were speaking, something that I would attribute as some values that SIAT holds, that is generosity and solidarity. Just really fantastic. And you're also reminding me of a conversation we had with another guest in Chicago, Naomi Davis, who was providing many of us TPLers a tour in Chicago. And she was trying to impart upon us a new language around fellowship. In other words, following the people. So folks like TPL coming into a space and following the leaders of community from behind, because you all do lay out the work. You have the relationships, you have the knowledge, it's generational, you know, you can't break that up. You can't dismantle that. That's information that lives on forever. So thank you for that. I do want to transition into another section, and this will maybe be our last section before we wrap up. And it's going back to the Outdoors for All Act and thinking about other federal dollars and federal funding opportunities. And Erica, I hope you're taking a sip of water, because I'm asking you a lot. I'm asking you to share so much. But I know that SIAT has had some experiences navigating federal funding in the federal system, and you've got some wisdom to pass along. And that wisdom that you have was also something that was passed on to you. So going back to this notion of solidarity, do you have any helpful hints to share about what some of the smaller local communities can do when they're interested in taking advantage of federal funding?
Yeah, I think a lot of times we think we have to present a certain way, have to be an organization, you know, that's inside of this box that fits this mold in order to receive the funding, because we've been shut out historically from these dollars. We have found champions that have held our hand to say, let us help you get you what you need in order to, you know, be your own fiscal. You know, you don't have to come under the fiscal agency of anyone else. You're going to, you know, manage your own dollars and do the work. You are enough. So to my community members out there who are saying, we don't know how to do, you know, go after government grants, or what do we need to get government dollars? If you are in partnership or have a local government entity that you are working with, that is an ask, because we ask our friends to help us that way too. Like, you know what you can do for us? Maybe it's not funding. Maybe it's just help us get in position to receive our own funding. Decode this spreadsheet that was just sent to me that I don't understand. That's in y'all's language. Like, please translate this for me. Not every time is it going to make sense. Sometimes it is a challenge. It is a challenge for me, all the way to logging into Teams when I have meetings with government entities. I hate Teams. And I'm just like, all the way from the Teams meeting to the spreadsheets to, you know, this language that they use to a lot of times the fear or apprehension that they project when there's a change of administration, all of that. We don't care about that. We just want to do the work in our community, so we understand that we have to show up a certain way in order to do the work. So I would say, reach out to SIAT. Go to our website. We will help you all kind of get the information. We will share what we know. But I also think that a lot of times we made it more daunting than what it was. And when I actually went on to the website and filled out the paperwork, and it came back and said, you know, congratulations, you're now a vendor, or whatever the case may be, I'm like, is that all? Like, whoever like discouraged us from getting this status, like, we could have been, you know, been here. But again, if you need help, go to a champion. If you can't find one in your local community, definitely reach out to us, because someone helped us along the way as well.
I love it. Thank you. Sean, I'd love to hear your reflections on that and the role of, I don't know, are we that friend to our community partner, and kind of other thoughts you might have about getting the funding to our local people?
Absolutely. Definitely agree with Erica about the importance of being authentic and relatable. That's critical in our work, especially when engaged in communities of color. It's like a prerequisite for gaining trust. Like, we have to be able to communicate in a way that resonates with our folks. And part of that is understanding the origin story for in like the environmental injustices that I mentioned before. We can't move at the pace of, you know, bureaucracy. We have to move at community pace. And even if that means like slowing down sometimes before we can speed up, like really understanding where the friction points are, understanding the story arc of a community, if you will, so we can understand where TPL can best be of service. Our ecosystem can be very complex at times. And I think as a local staff and sort of the face of the organization here locally, it's important for us to be able to distill and communicate all of the functionalities of TPL in a way that helps us to not only understand where those injustices might lie and how they are relevant to a community's backstory, but then also, like, what are we trying to accomplish beyond just building access and making those connections? There are a myriad of health priorities that are really prevalent in communities of color, everything from, you know, poor mental health to physical inactivity that lead to so many physical health challenges that we deal with as a culture. So knowing how, you know, to baseline it so that we can look at, you know, performance as we make those incremental steps are only going to improve the value proposition, if you will, when you make, when we are making a request for funding or to continue programming. So being able to measure performance and really show incremental gain. It's not going to be something that happens overnight, which is why we talk about importance of long-term stewardship and having those really strong partnerships that don't necessarily fizzle out after, you know, the celebration moment or ribbon cutting. Like we're in it for the long term. And so those partnerships are really critical to, one, establishing the trust, growing on that trust, and then really being able to show impact in a way that will resonate continuously with future funding.
Well, this has been great. I've learned a lot, and I have the privilege of having spoken with you all before, and I still, these are not aspirations per se. These are this is action, right? You all are living in action. These are, you have evidence. You know, at TPL, we really like to have evidence-based approaches with the work that we're doing, and your lived experience, your family's leadership, your education, your own, you know, travels throughout various parts of the United States and working in different sectors. That is your lived experience. That's your evidence, if you will, excuse me. I just want to thank you both for joining us here on People, Nature, Big Ideas. It's just been a delight. And I know that this took a lot of time for you all. So I appreciate you sharing your time with me. Do you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to share or anything you want the audience to know?
Thank you for inviting me. This is wonderful. Saya, that was an opportunity to share the great work that we're doing and other folks are doing, you know, who are doing similar work. My call to action for my community would be to trust us. Those of us who are out here kind of saying, hey, we're here, you know, come on out and experience this. Trust us. Try it. Have fun. Hopefully you love it. If not, tweak it and make it yours. But get your time outside of nature. It does a body good. Let me just say it that way. And to all of our organizations that are saying, what can we do to make sure more folks of color are experiencing these parks that are deemed all of ours? Hit up SIAD, hit up other organizations like SIAD, look at me to your community and use all that knowledge that you have at your fingertips and make sure that, you know, respect, I guess, in a way, the expertise that is out there and, you know, use it to everyone's benefit so that we can make sure these spaces begin to, you know, look different as we, you know, look out for the next decades to come. I want my kids to experience something that I wasn't able to experience. And that's, you know, national parks and national spaces and local parks that are invested in and representative of all.
Thank you, Erica. Perfect. Sean?
Thank you, Rhonda. An amazing opportunity to connect with both of y'all. This is wonderful. I too have learned a ton. If there was any call to action to community, it would be to really trust the experience or trust Republic Land. We've been at this work for 50 years and continue to be a beacon for community. The Ohio office in particular is one that the organization has really, truly been committed to growing. And our office is one of the oldest field offices and within the ecosystem of TPL. So there's a lot of institutional knowledge that have run through these walls. We are a leaner staff, but we have a statewide reach in Ohio. We're looking for partnerships like SIAD and other cities. This year, we'll be exploring park equity in Cincinnati. And if there are Cincinnati folks who are interested in engaging with us, please do reach out. We have four Ohio park score cities, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Toledo, as well as Columbus. So we're really looking and invested in strong partnerships in these key cities, interested in peer city dialogue across the four cities, and want to be connecting with our rural partners as well. There's a lot of Ohio to see beyond those four cities. So please reach out to us. Trust the work that we've done in the past and the work that is yet to come.
Awesome. Thank you, Sean. And thanks to all of you all for listening. As I mentioned, our next episode is part of that three-part series on the Outdoors for All Act. And the next time we talk, we're going to be going to Maine, where we'll have an opportunity to engage with members of the Penobscot tribe, and they'll be sharing what the impact of outdoors legislation and what it means to their community. And then in April, we'll be joining others from TPL for the Day on the Hill event. It'll be a deep dive into how important legislation like the Outdoors for All Act is, how it's created, how we lobby for it, and then hopefully how we see it get passed. So please stay tuned for that. People, Nature, Big Ideas is produced by the Trust for Public Land in partnership with Pretty Good Productions. Our executive producer is Thomas Clayton Miller. Our producer is Vanessa Martin, and our associate producer is Alyssa Morley. Our theme song was produced by Tall Black Guy Productions. And if you like the show, please leave us a rating on iTunes and maybe mention us to one or two of your friends. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.